is Ed Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Keith Brownhill. On today's edition, Margot Patterson talks with Tracy McLeod of FORJ, Family and Friends Organizing for Reform of Juvenile Justice. You will learn some things about charging juveniles as adults that you didn't know. In the second half of the show, Ali Christine Bush talks with Nicole Porter of the Sentencing Project about their research into sentencing policies state by state and more. Have your pencils and paper ready for our calendar of events and stick around for the 420 drug war news after the show. And now here's Margot and Tracy.
This is Margot Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. 10,000 children under the age of 18 are incarcerated in adult jails and prisons in the United States, where an estimated 250,000 youth go before the adult criminal court every year. According to the National Juvenile Justice Network, in some states, children as young as 13 are rubbing shoulders with seasoned criminals. This occurs, though the research shows that prosecuting children as adults does not improve public safety and, in fact, increases the risks that youths will reoffend. It also places youths jailed in adult prisons at significant risk of rape and other types of mental and physical harm and leaves them without access to education. The treatment accorded juvenile offenders, especially those in adult prisons, is the subject of today's interview. My guest is Tracy McLeod, the founder of Families and Friends Organizing for Reform of Juvenile Justice. FORJ is dedicated to ending the practice of placing children and youth under the age of 18 in Missouri's jails and prisons. It also advocates that all children in Missouri's juvenile or adult criminal justice system be provided the necessary rehabilitation needed to become productive members of society when they leave. Tracy McLeod, welcome.
Hi, and thank you for having me.
Tracy, I'm wondering if we could begin by talking about your family's experience, because it's that experience that prompted you to establish FORJ. And here let me mention that Tracy is the mother of Jonathan McLeod, who tragically died in prison at age 17, 7 weeks after he was sentenced to 30 years in a maximum security prison in Missouri. Tracy, how did that event lead you to what you're doing today?
Well, obviously it was one of the most horrible things that could happen to a person in their entire lifetime. Not only are you losing your child, but you're losing total control of what happens to your child. You can't see them. You can't talk to them. You can't send them things. There is a wall that goes up as soon as they are arrested and you are shut out. So I had never had this type of experience with our justice system before, and I remember thinking that as things progressed, I was just shocked over and over and over again that the United States of America is treating our children and our families this way by throwing our children away and allowing them to be abused and totally shutting the families out so that there's nothing that we can do about it and it's legal.
I was very surprised to learn some of what you've said. You mentioned that Jonathan was transferred something like 8 times during 6 months, and you had no idea where he was.
Exactly.
And I take it this is very common. Is this the rule in most states?
I can't speak of other states. I do federal work, but Missouri is the only state that I know the law as well as I do. But I do work with other parents across the nation, and they have all said the same things. It's pretty common.
And why is it important, you think, that juveniles convicted in adult court serve their sentence in juvenile facilities rather than adult prisons?
Well, to start with, I don't think any child should ever be tried as an adult or placed in adult court. But Missouri does have a facility in Montgomery City for kids who are tried as adults, for kids who have committed more serious offenses. The difference between that facility and the juvenile facilities as compared to being put in the adult system is in juvenile facilities, the whole outlook for children is to give them a second chance of being a productive member of society. Everything that caused them to run afoul of the law is treated within the juvenile system. They get their education, they get mental health services, they get counseling, they get victim empathy. If they have a drug problem, which the majority of children who run across the juvenile justice system have some sort of drug issue, that is, all of those pieces are put together with total family involvement. And in Missouri's dual jurisdiction program, which does treat children as adults within their one facility, their success rate is so high that it has gotten an award from Harvard University. It's renowned across Missouri and other countries that try to copy it. If you place a child in an adult court or house them in an adult jail or an adult prison, they receive no services at all. They have no mental health services, no drug rehab services, no education. Any type of service that you can think of, it is not geared towards youth, and it does not work. Besides that, youth who are held in adult court are 36 times more likely to commit suicide, as is what happened to my son. They die either physically or mentally because, one, they are put with the general population where they're targeted for physical or sexual abuse, or to keep them safe, they are put in isolation where their mental health plummets and suicide is a high rate because it's considered a form of torture. And there is another movement going across the country about solitary confinement, and we're putting our youth in solitary confinement, and it's disgusting. In the juvenile facility, youth are given everything they could possibly need to become productive members of society again. Youth are highly amenable to rehabilitation, and Missouri has a really good program in their juvenile services run by the Department of Youth Services, as well as the same program is called the Dual Jurisdiction Program, and it is for kids who have been certified as an adult, and they can receive the same juvenile services as kids who have remained in the juvenile system.
I think some people may not be familiar, I wasn't, with that phrase, certified as adults, and what it means. Could you say a little bit about what it does mean and how the process works?
Sure. Each state calls it something different, but in Missouri it is called certification as an adult. And what it means is if a child does a more serious crime, then they are in danger of being tried as an adult. That means they will go before a juvenile judge, and the judge will take them out of the juvenile system and refer them to the adult system, where they will go before an adult judge and be tried as an adult. And when that happens, you as a parent and their family can no longer be privy to what they and their lawyer talk about, because now they are an adult. It doesn't matter how young they are. In Missouri, we can certify children as adults, put them in adult court as young as 12. There is a loophole in Missouri that can plummet that age as low as possible. Right now, we have 13, 14, 15, 16-year-olds in adult jails in Missouri. And 17-year-olds in Missouri are considered adults. So they're not being certified as an adult because in Missouri they're already considered adults. So it doesn't matter what they do. It doesn't matter how minor it is. They immediately go to the adult court. And once you are in an adult court, especially with a felony, then it makes it very hard once you get out of that system for a child, because they now have a felony record, to get a loan for college, to rent an apartment, to get a loan for a car or a home. Any of those normal things that you would normally do as you grow up, you can't do. There's always a block that will be there.
Well, it seems shocking to me that children 12, 13, 14 could be tried as adults. Has that been the case for decades? What is the conceivable rationale for that?
It started happening in the mid-90s. There were a couple of high-profile cases in the 90s that for some reason just blew up in the media. And this term called super predator came out, and it was supposed to refer to these children who were ganging up together and just going out to attack anybody. And the funny thing is, that never surfaced. Nothing like that ever happened. But all across the state, it was like wildfire. All of these laws started changing, calling it tough on crime and making it really, really easy to put our children in the adult court system.
If I understand correctly, the pre-detention of youth in adult facilities is also of concern to you and your organization. That is, youth who, before they go to trial, are being held. What are the conditions that youth face in those facilities?
What happens is when a child is in, when they're first arrested, they're in the juvenile facility, but the day that they are certified as an adult, they go straight from the courtroom to the adult jail, which is what happened to Jonathan. When he was there, our visits dropped to once a week, and he was behind glass, and we had to talk to him on a phone. And when we spoke to him, he would talk about how the lights were on all the time, and all the adults were up all night, and he would try to take his shower in mid-morning when they were all asleep so he wasn't in danger of being assaulted. He was really, really intelligent. This happened to him right after his sophomore year of high school. So he tried to study his GED books because he was officially dropped from the high school roster the day that he was certified as an adult. So he wanted to get his GED. But he said that it was just too noisy and nobody cared, and so he said there was no way that I can study for it. And then he moved to another jail facility, and I called and called and called the supervisor of that facility because I was extremely worried about his safety. And I was told, don't worry, you know, we're going to put him with some of the adults down here that we can trust that'll watch over him, blah blah blah. He was moved on a Thursday, and I just kind of figured out the pattern after a while that it seems like they always moved him on Thursday because he, as you said before, he was moved 8 times, but we never knew where he was until he had a chance to get to a phone and call us. And sometimes it was that day, sometimes it was a couple days later. We just never knew. Anyway, so the first night that he was moved to that second jail facility, that was a Thursday. Our first visit was on a Monday. We had to visit between 1 and 4 o'clock for 15 minutes through glass. And the first time we went to visit was the Monday after he had been there a few days. And what we saw was a beaten and bruised boy. His hair was shaved off. He had a teardrop tattoo that he was told he needed to survive. And all he said was, don't worry about me, Mom. I'm the one that got me into this, and you just don't worry about me.
This is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio, and if you're just tuning in, I'm here talking to Tracy McClard, the founder of Families and Friends, Organizing for Reform of Juvenile Justice. Tracy, you were just talking about Jonathan. Could you tell a little bit about the tragic circumstances that led to his incarceration?
Sure. He had gotten involved with this girl about a year before this happened, in the fall of 2006. And he just loved her to death. He just thought she was the greatest. And she was. She was, you know, she came from a very difficult family life, but she spent a lot of time at our house, and we grew to love her too. So they dated, you know, through his sophomore year of high school. She was a couple years younger than he was. She was 14. And in May of the following year, in May of 2007, I left because I was in the Army at the time, and I had to go for training in another state. And when I left him, he was really looking forward to colleges and scholarships. So we went to the high school graduation that year just to see what all the different scholarships were that he could get. And that's how I left him, and he was happy. And then after I was gone for a couple of weeks, I was going to be gone for, I think it was 7 weeks that summer, because I was going to be back on July 13th. Yeah. So after I had been gone for a couple of weeks, I would talk to him every night. And you know, one time he said, well, you know, she broke up with me. And I said, well, sweetheart, I'm really sorry. And I said, are you okay? And he said, well, I'm really bummed out. But, you know, he was okay with it at first. I mean, he was really bummed out, like any 16-year-old would be that lost his girlfriend, but that he just thought was so all was it. But he was okay. But then after a couple weeks, the conversation started to change. She had gotten a new boyfriend, and he started to say, Mom, you know, he's beating her up. Mom, he's raping her. Mom, he's forcing her to do cocaine. Mom, he's doing this. Mom, he's doing that. And I was like, Jonathan, that doesn't even make sense, because you know her, and she would not let him do this. If this was happening, you know, she wouldn't be with him. But he believed all of this was happening. He thoroughly believed all of this was happening. So on July the 10th, he got a phone call from her that morning, and they had gotten together a couple weeks before and slept together, and she called and told him that she was pregnant and that the new boyfriend was going to force her to shoot up cocaine to kill the baby, but that she was going to commit suicide before that could happen. So in his mind, he was thinking that two people's lives are in danger. So he called the boyfriend, and, you know, I don't know how that happened, but anyway, later that day, they ended up, both ended up at the car wash, and Jonathan ended up shooting the ex-boyfriend 3 times, and told me from the very beginning that I only wanted to scare him, and the police will understand why I did what I did, because I'm saving 2 lives, I'm saving a baby, which there never was a baby, and I am not blaming the girl, and I am not blaming the other boyfriend. It's just, you know, and there were drugs involved, because Jonathan started doing these at the time, and they're probably still calling it triple C's, but it was a new type of drug, and it was, you can take over-the-counter Coracetin D, which has dextromethorphan in it, and you can build up the amount that you take to where you don't feel anything, and so he started doing that over the summer so he wouldn't feel anything. And so the day that he shot this boy, he just was not there, you know.
I know that this past year, in 2013, Forge was instrumental in helping the passage in Missouri of Jonathan's Law, named yes. after your son. What does Jonathan's Law mandate?
So it deals directly with the dual jurisdiction program, which is the program I spoke of earlier for kids who have been placed in the adult system, kids that have done a more serious crime. The boy that Jonathan shot did not die, thankfully. Right after the incident, I had this overwhelming urge to pray for my son, and my husband had the overwhelming urge to pray for the boy that Jonathan shot. And he survived. So to get into the dual jurisdiction program, not only does a child have to be certified as an adult, but a staff member of the Department of Youth Services will come and interview your child. It's about a 2-hour interview, and they will give a recommendation to the court of, yes, we want this child in our program, or no, we don't think it's a good fit. And the Department of Youth Services generally, I mean, they accept just about all children. I think they've denied 2 since the mid-90s when it was started. Jonathan was highly recommended for the program because he just had goals. He had things going for him. He had a lot of friends. He did so well in school, The person that interviewed him told me, he said, Tracy, he's already rehabilitated. He knows what he did was wrong, and he's got so many goals. He said, you know, I really hope they let us have him, but the court jurisdiction that he's in generally are hard for us to work with. So that was the recommendation from DYS. That's where Jonathan should have gone. But that day that we went to court, a representative from DYS actually came to court. His name was Brent Burek, and tried to talk the judge into letting Jonathan into their program. And I found out later that normally a DYS rep doesn't come. They just send the recommendation in the letter. But in this case, he came, and the judge would not listen to a thing he said. And the judge said, I am not going to let him go in 10 years, or I'm not going to let him go in 4 years. I'm not going to let him go in 10 years. I'm not going to let him go. He said, I am a statistic that program does not work. I was the first judge in the state of Missouri to sentence a child to the dual jurisdiction program. That child left the state, went to Chicago, and shot somebody else. So I will never, ever sentence another child to the dual jurisdiction program. So the dual jurisdiction program has a 93% success rate to start off with. The second thing I found out about a year and a half ago is the judge lied, because they went back and tried to find that youth that the judge was talking about that went to Chicago and shot somebody else, and that child doesn't exist. So Jonathan ended up with a 30-year prison sentence, and 7 weeks later he died.
Is it totally up to the judge then whether a child is certified, well, one, goes into the dual jurisdiction system, but also is certified as an adult? Who decides that?
It's up to the judge. The certification is up to the juvenile judge, and then whether the child goes into the dual jurisdiction program or into the adult Department of Corrections is up to the adult judge. So Jonathan's law, back to that quickly, is it addressed three things about dual jurisdiction that kept Jonathan out. One is all judges have to consider dual jurisdiction as an option, and that's more of an education piece, because there are a lot of jurisdictions in Missouri that aren't aware that we have this excellent program. The second piece is before Jonathan's law, the whole court process had to be done by the child's 17th birthday, which made us feel very, very rushed, because Jonathan committed his crime 6 months before his 17th birthday. So Jonathan's law gives the court an additional 6 months and gives DYS an additional 6 months to get the process done. The third piece is because the judge lied in our case. If a judge goes against the recommendation of DYS, if DYS accepts a child into the program and the judge goes against that, he has to write a finding in court of why he goes against the recommendation of the state child experts.
And is that judge that sentenced Jonathan, is he still on the bench?
Yes. There's a statute in Missouri called Once an Adult, Always an Adult, and it was for all children, no matter if they were ever convicted of a crime or not. All children that were certified as an adult would ever, forever have to be in the adult court, no matter what they did after that, whether they, you know, stole a pack of gum out of a store or whatever. So it took all kids who were found not guilty or charges were dropped, they were able, if they ever did something again, they were able to stay in the juvenile system.
Tracy McClard, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now the calendar for April 28, 2014. The Kansas City chapter of Missouri Association for Social Welfare's First Friday Forum will be Friday, April 2nd, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri. Their guest, Joanna Sabilian, Chief Resource Officer of Harvesters Community Food Network, will speak on Hunger Does Not Take a Summer Vacation. For more information, contact Ann Johnson at 816-520-3377 or email at acjohnson.4550@yahoo.com. The Kansas City Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will meet Tuesday, May 6, 6:30 p.m. at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. They will be joined by Jim Humphrey, a former Missouri prosecutor who will share why he opposes the death penalty. Blue Hills Community Service will be conducting a quality of life workshop titled You, Your Job Search, and the Workplace. Get help and learn about what it takes to be ready to secure employment, a job search process, and employer expectations. The workshop will be Tuesday, May 6th from 9 a.m. to noon at Blue Hills Community Service, 5008 Prospect, Kansas City, Missouri. You must reserve a spot by calling 816-333-7870, extension 203, or send an email to Leigh, L-E-I-G-H, at bhcsmo.org. My name is Keith Brown Eel, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Up next is Allie and her guest, Nicole Porter, on the Sentencing Project.
Good morning. Again, this is Allie Catherine Bush, your host on KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. This is a live telephone interview on Jaws of Justice, and we will be speaking to Nicole D. Porter. She is the Director of Advocacy for the Sentencing Project Organization. Good morning, Ms. Porter.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you to give us some information about your educational background and then explain to us how the Sentencing Project Organization came into existence and what is the mission.
Sure. Well, regarding my educational background, I got my bachelor's at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and majored in international studies there and got my master's in public affairs from the University of Texas at Austin at the LBJ School of Public Affairs a few years ago. The Sentencing Project is a research and advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C. We're a national organization and do federal and state advocacy. As the director of advocacy, I focus on state reform and work with organizers and individuals interested in addressing trends regarding incarceration. The Sentencing Project works to address trends in incarceration through our research. We publish several research reports a year and then work to advocate for policy reform to address what triggers a prison sentence, the length of confinement for people who are incarcerated, and promote alternatives to incarceration to reduce America's reliance on incarceration as a social policy. And we've been around for about 25 years now.
Okay, and I know that you do have some background with the American Civil Liberties Union.
Yes, I used to work with the Texas affiliate of the ACLU. I directed the Prison and Jail Accountability Project, which was a state-specific project in Texas, monitoring conditions of confinement in state prisons and county jails. My focus was legislative-based, and during my tenure, we passed a state version of the Federal Prison Rape Elimination Act and also worked to address medical care for incarcerated persons.
All right. My focus here a little bit is about the drug policy in the country that is causing so many black males to be the majority of people in the prison system. So I know you're working to change Americans' views of the prison system and how it looks like they're punishing more than rehabilitating. So what can you tell us about your progress on making changes in prison reform?
Sure. Well, certainly a sizable proportion of the prison population at the federal and state level is for people convicted of drug offenses. And there is a racial disparity in incarceration. African Americans overwhelmingly comprise a large portion of prison populations despite their representation in the general community and despite their reported use of drugs. For example, African Americans report that they use drugs at the same rate of proportion to their representation in the general community. Blacks are about 13% of the general community and they're about 13% of drug users, and that bears out in self-reporting surveys that are published each year, and yet blacks are overwhelmingly represented for people convicted of drug offenses. That's most clear at the federal level in persons, African Americans convicted of crack offenses, where blacks comprise about 86% of those sentenced to federal prison for crack offenses, despite only reporting about 13% of using crack in the community. So, you know, that's a reflection of the way drug policies are enforced. When the, you know, when the escalation of drug policies were adopted starting in the 1970s as an approach to deterring drug use, lawmakers assumed that lengthening terms of confinement and changing state and federal sentencing structures requiring mandatory minimums for certain drug offenses would deter drug use, but that hasn't been the case. That approach has only resulted in an explosion of our nation's incarceration rate, and we now know, after years of observation and research, that there are more effective ways to reduce drug use. If that is a goal of lawmakers in terms of using the criminal justice system as a way to reduce drug offenses and to reduce drug crime, and so that's why one part of our mission is to promote alternatives to incarceration, because there are evidence-based approaches such as rehabilitation and community-based treatment programs that are proven to be more effective in reducing recidivism for people convicted of drug offenses.
Okay. I was reviewing a lot of your information on the website, and you talk about a primer. I believe that would be when, even at the elementary level with juveniles, that the system starts recording records on juveniles, and this starts them on a path to more crime. So what can you say about your progress on working with the juveniles?
Well, certainly bringing people in contact with the criminal justice system could lead them to further contact with the system because of the criminogenic effect of either juvenile justice system for youthful defendants or jail or prison for adult defendants who are first-time offenders. So, you know, going into prison or going into a juvenile detention facility in and of itself could be criminogenic for offenders brought into the system. And so that, again, is why one of the main goals of the Sentencing Project is to promote alternatives to incarceration, because not only are evidence-based programs shown to be more effective in reducing recidivism, thus improving public safety, but they can also be, as a part of that public safety strategy, can also help to prevent future criminal offending for people brought in contact with the system. And so certainly for youthful defendants who, because of, you know, high exposure to violence in their home life or living in, you know, high poverty areas and who are at risk for, you know, coming in contact with the juvenile justice system, determining effective interventions for at-risk youth so that they are, so they do not come in contact with the criminal justice system or the juvenile justice system to begin with, is a goal. And so, you know, it's the Sentencing Project's hope that lawmakers and community members will work to put interventions into place so that at-risk youth don't come into contact with the system to begin with, because certainly once a youth becomes arrested and goes into the system, there is a possibility of, you know, continuing to learn criminal behavior and, you know, not being improved as a result of being in the system, but only being exposed to potential acts of offending.
Okay. I also noticed in your review that the organization feels that since the Jim Crow laws back in 1876 through 1965, that this seemed to be like the state and local levels were using the drug laws, the war on drugs, as a way to control the black community, especially the males. So we are looking at the Civil Rights Act that was in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965 that kind of gave us our civil rights back again against these Jim Crow laws. It affects the family as well, women that have been in prison, and also when they had the laws that say you will be penalized and not get food stamps or things on that level to help the family, that this also impacts on the black community as well as other minorities. What is the progress being done now towards giving the food stamps back and other benefits?
Sure. Well, just one thing is that, you know, I think because African Americans are overwhelmingly live in high poverty areas, which overlaps with high incarceration areas, that is one of the primary reasons that blacks are overrepresented in the criminal justice system. And so you can trace sort of the level of enforcement in this country, you know, from slavery and sort of enforcing the African American community in certain low-income communities using social policy such as slavery through, you know, post-Reconstruction era to the Jim Crow regime to post-Jim Crow, where the use of law enforcement in certain communities, particularly in low-income communities of color in the inner city, was strengthened as a way to socially control certain communities, and certainly the adoption of the war on drugs as a regime, you know, starting in the early 1970s, and investing, prioritizing resources towards law enforcement helped to, you know, increase the rate of arrest, and explains why the nation's prison population exploded, started in the 1970s to now, you know, from 600%, from about 300,000 people locked up in the early 70s to about 2.2 million locked up today in state prisons or jails, and also in federal prisons at the national level. There has been movement despite that sort of bleak picture that I just laid out, in terms of critiquing the way incarceration has been used to socially control certain communities, the devastating impact on high incarceration communities, many times high incarceration communities in communities of color, and you know, the work of the Sentencing Project and allied organizations has worked to shed light on that narrative for the last 25 years or more in critiquing the high rate of incarceration in this country. And because of that, there has been work to scale back the collateral consequences that people are subjected to even after they've completed their sentence. Those collateral consequences are what we call civil sanctions. So if you have a felony conviction, you may lose your right to vote for life in certain states like Virginia and Florida, unless you are pardoned by the governor, or you may lose access to public benefits. Specifically, for food stamp benefits, you lose access to them. You can lose access to them for life if you have a felony drug conviction. So that's the only conviction that can subject you to a federal lifetime ban for food stamps. And Missouri is one of nine states that continues to impose this federal food stamp ban. And right now there's legislation underway in Missouri that I'm hopeful will be adopted this year and is being anchored by the Missouri Association of Social Welfare. So if your listeners are interested in getting engaged, they can reach out to MASW and they can find them online and support the current effort to expand eligibility for people convicted of felony food stamp conviction who are currently ineligible to receive food stamps. And just quickly, other collateral consequences that people may be subjected to are, you know, restrictions on housing in the public or private rental market if you have a felony conviction. And also people with felony drug convictions also are ineligible to receive federal student grants or student loans to pursue higher education.
Okay. Recently in the news, we've heard about the death of a Reuben Hurricane Carter that was wrongfully convicted, and finally he was released. Information about the Trayvon Martin case, where attitudes were mixed on whether or not he was getting justice. And Mr. Bundy, I believe the cattle rancher, his attitudes, and also this Donald Sterling, the owner of the Clippers in Los Angeles. These attitudes really affect us, and so we think that these people that are concerned should contact your organization for assistance on any problems that they're having, and to contact your senator or whoever that can give you assistance. What do you say about people that are concerned?
Well, you know, we're an advocacy organization and a research organization, so we certainly, you know, encourage people who want to address mass incarceration to find us online. Mm-hmm. They can Google us, The Sentencing Project, or find us at our website, address@sentencingproject.org, and we can connect them to a range of information on sentencing issues and collateral consequences. They can also look at information by state and learn more about Missouri or other states that they're interested in by looking at our website. We certainly think that people should be weighing in with their elected officials, and, you know, certainly there's a large number of people who are listening who may be directly impacted who are ineligible to vote because they, you know, have a felony conviction. However, if, you know, people are living in the community and they participate in the social contract by working every day and paying taxes, then they should be communicating with the people who represent their communities and raise the issue of mass incarceration and how it affects them, their community, their family, their loved ones, and in the general community that they're concerned with. So, you know, we do encourage folks to reach out to their U.S. senators, their congressperson, and also their state representatives. I mentioned earlier that there's current legislation that would expand eligibility in the state of Missouri to people convicted of felony drug offenses who are ineligible for food stamps, so people can weigh in directly that way. And they can also weigh in with their elected officials on, you know, raising concerns around mass incarceration overall.
Okay. Ms. Porter, I'm going to take a second here to let our listeners know that this is Allie Catherine Bush with Jaws of Justice on KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. You are listening to Nicole Porter in Washington, D.C., who is an advocate for Sentencing Project Organization. I know you have a lot of statistics concerning how we got into the situation that has caused people to be in prison. I know that there was 14 examples of racism that perpetuates, you know, this legal system. Can you tell us some things about that are that have been impacted to make changes?
Sure. Well, you know, the representation, the overrepresentation of African Americans and other communities of color in the criminal justice system starts from the point of arrest to the point of sentencing to the point of release from prison, and then can also bear out in returns to prison for people living in supervision on probation or parole. And so strategies around success have focused on providing people under some form of surveillance in the community, so people on probation or parole, with services to reduce recidivism and increase public safety. So reducing recidivism would reduce returns to prison. And we know that if people are gainfully employed, this bears out in self-report studies of people exiting prison who are followed, you know, post-release, and who report that, you know, the best ways to stay out of prison for them is if they have gainful employment where they can support themselves and their families, if they have access to a stable housing, if their support networks are strong and in place, Family support and a support system that can help them navigate the struggles of daily life is in place. So to the extent that there are successful strategies, people interested in building interventions to improve public safety could target efforts there. We also know that in preventing crime altogether, focusing on effective interventions that can be targeted to at-risk youth is our effective public safety strategies, again, with the goal of reducing contact with the criminal justice system altogether. So reducing arrest amongst the at-risk youth population and reducing sentences to prison for the at-risk youth population. And effective interventions that have been shown are early childhood education for at-risk children so that they can learn to resolve conflict very early on in life and receive motivation at an early age so that that can affect their life outcomes as older children and young adults. And we also know that delivering effective therapeutic services to at-risk adolescents and their family members to, again, find effective ways to resolve conflict within the family without resulting in physical violence, and providing the necessary services to at-risk families so that housing is stable, employment is stable, and the everyday stressors that low-income families with at-risk adolescents face can be navigated in a way that would reduce a youth's contact with the criminal justice system, that those are all critical interventions that people in the community interested in public safety should be focused on. And there's evidence to document which programs are effective, and the Sentencing Project has information available from our website, and your listeners can certainly get in touch with me if they're interested in learning specifically about what programs might be helpful in their communities.
Okay, thank you for that information. Before you leave, I just wanted to mention one of your staff people that I read about when I was reviewing your organization, Mr. Mark Maurer. He does testify occasionally before Congress about these issues. And
he does. Yes, yeah, he does.
So I just wanted to mention his name. And then also, if people do want to get in touch with you, if they don't have access to a computer, they can go to the library where they can get help there to go to your website. Would you mention that website?
Yes, it's sentencingproject.org, so that's sentencingproject.org. It's also probably just easy to Google us.
Okay.
And they go to the website when they go to the Internet.
All right. I have so many statistics here today that we wouldn't have time to talk about on this program, but I would like to invite you back to bring us updated information on your progress on different issues around the country, and just feel free to let us know when you're available.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right.
Ready? One, two, three. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events or a link to our show episode and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at www.kkfi.org or at 90.1 FM. My name is Lee Moore, and we thank our engineer, Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m. followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, the Arts Magazine with Michael Hove. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical. Make myself a better man.
It's the 420 Drug War News. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder.
In 2010, President Obama signed the Fair Sentencing Act, reducing unfair disparities in sentences imposed on people for offenses involving different forms of cocaine. But there are still too many people in federal prison who were sentenced under the old regime and who, as a result, will have to spend far more time in prison than they would if sentenced today for exactly the same crime. This is simply not right. Legislation pending in Congress would help address these types of cases. But in the meantime, President Obama took a sensible step towards addressing the situation by granting commutations last December to 8 men and women who had each served more than 15 years in prison for crack cocaine offenses. For two of these individuals, it was the first conviction they'd ever received. Yet, due to mandatory minimum guidelines that were considered severe at the time and are profoundly out of date today, they and four others received life sentences. Now, these stories illustrate the vital role that the clemency process can play in America's justice system. The White House has indicated it wants to consider additional clemency applications to restore a degree of justice, fairness, and proportionality for deserving individuals who do not pose a threat to public safety. The Justice Department is committed to recommending as many qualified applicants as possible for reduced sentences. Later this week, the Deputy Attorney General will announce new criteria that the department will consider when recommending applications for the President's review. This new and improved approach will make the criteria for clemency recommendation more expansive. This will allow the Department of Justice and the President to consider requests from a larger field of eligible individuals. Once these reforms go into effect, we expect to receive thousands of additional applications for clemency. And we at the Department of Justice will meet this need by assigning potentially dozens of lawyers with backgrounds in both prosecution and defense to review applications and provide the rigorous scrutiny that all clemency applications require. As a society, we pay much too high a price whenever our system fails to deliver the just outcomes necessary to deter and punish crime, to keep us safe, and to ensure that those who have paid their debts have a chance to become productive citizens. Our expanded clemency application process will aid in this effort, and it will advance the aims of our innovative new Smart on Crime initiative to strengthen the criminal justice system, promote public safety, and deliver on the promise of equal justice under law.
This is Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.